I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos was interviewed by Dana Bash on CNN on Sunday and asked about her plans for reopening the nation's schools. It did not go well.
What if the school district feels that they can't safely go into the school because there is a flare-up in that district? Remote learning, are you okay with it in that situation?
If there's a short-term flare-up for a few days, that's a different situation than planning for an entire school year in anticipation of something that hasn't happened. That's a very different thing. Kids have got to be back in school. They've got to be back in the classroom. And working families have to have their children in school.
Should be back in school. Nobody is disagreeing with that.
Now, most parents, most teachers, even most children want to return to the classroom, but safety is of primary importance. It's unclear what that would look like and what it would take to ensure that students, teachers, and school personnel would not spread and would not get sick from coronavirus. Today on Radio Times, the pros and cons of reopening schools amid the pandemic and ensuring that all children get the benefits of an education. We begin with Anya Kamenetz. She joins us by Skype, and she's education correspondent for NPR, author of a book called The Art of Screen Time, How Your Family Can Balance Digital Media and Real Life. Anya Kamenetz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning.
This was part of a larger, rather contentious interview having to do with the education secretary's preparedness for opening the schools. And she was very, I would say, pretty unclear about what that preparedness would look like. I'm just curious, how much power does the education secretary have in the decision to open schools in districts across the country?
Well, that's a really interesting question because, you know, this particular education secretary has been really notable for her emphasis on the idea of local control, in promoting alternatives to the public schools, and for her to come out to say that, you know, the administration, the federal government should be pressing and pressuring districts to reopen when every state in this country is in a different situation when it comes to the threat of coronavirus is really kind of a departure from her behavior in the past.
And a related question, President Trump has threatened to withhold funding to school districts that don't open schools once the school year comes around. Can the president do that?
This is kind of an amazing statement, right? Because first of all, no, the federal government in the whole controls about 10% or less of public school funding. So the money is not even in his hands to give out. The second part of this that's so amazing is opening schools safely is going to take a lot of money. And states don't have that money. They're in a historic budget crunch because the coronavirus recession. Right. So there's an unfunded mandate here, essentially, is what's coming from the federal government. It's going to take hundreds of billions of dollars to reopen schools safely.
It's interesting, and we're going to spend the rest of the hour sort of looking at how districts are going to decide about what to do. And it's really hard, Anya, to come up with a kind of one-size-fits-all. But what are some of the options facing these districts?
So, you know, baseline, right, what authorities are saying, and there have been many, many official expert recommendations coming out saying, first of all, you need to look at the baseline spread in the community, right? So if you have a hot spot, you just can't open schools because even the process of getting people to school might be too dangerous. If you have a more controlled spread, as you do in many places in the Northeast, then you start to look at, okay, how do we limit the possibility of cases happening in schools? And the top mitigation strategies that we're seeing include, obviously, hand washing, masks in many cases, especially for school staff. And the big one is limiting the size of groups that children are in. So reducing class size to allow for social distancing and reducing the crossover between groups of students so that you don't have large gatherings such as in the cafeteria or the auditorium.
We have a couple of weeks in some districts and maybe about a month in other districts before schools are set to reopen. How does a district or even a school deal with all the things that you just laid out there?
Well, it is a massive and unprecedented undertaking. And, you know, districts are advised to collaborate with public health officials to get input from all the stakeholders, from parents and teachers. You know, in many cases, it's going to come down to the custodial staff looking at what is our physical size of our classrooms? Do the windows open? Do we need to do deep cleaning? And so, I mean, I really don't envy the position that school leaders are in trying to craft these plans.
And we're talking obviously about districts, some of which are flush with money, although not probably as much as they used to have, and other districts like those here in the Philadelphia area that are not flush with money and are counting pennies even before this pandemic hit.
That's exactly right. So we're looking at districts in, you know, states across the country have cut hundreds of millions of dollars from education budgets, and they're laying off teachers in the midst of trying to reduce class sizes. So it really is a whipsaw kind of a situation where you're being asked to do more with less. And I think, you know, frankly, many working parents can relate to that same situation because we've got our kids at home. We're trying to work at the same time. And so everyone's being asked to do more with less or with nothing.
You're a working parent. How has the last couple of months been for you and your either children or child?
Well, the kids are hanging in there. They're definitely getting more screen time. My husband and I are working late at night. We're getting up early in the morning. And, you know, many, many parents, I'm sure, can relate.
Well, I think it can be said that most parents do want this to happen, but they just want to ensure that their children are not going to get sick or even be a kind of a spreader of the virus.
So that's a small bright spot, because what the research is telling us so far, and including in other countries where schools have reopened, is that children are much less likely to get ill from this virus, and they're very, very unlikely to get severely ill. So that is really one thing that kind of throws a question mark into the plans for safe reopening, because certainly there is risk to adult school staff, but with very young children, it's really unlikely that they're going to be getting sick.
But they could be a spreader.
Well, that's something that is a huge question mark. There's been a call for more research on that exact question. Do we know if kids can be asymptomatic spreaders? In some countries where they've done very sophisticated contact tracing, which we don't have in many places in the U.S., they found very, very few, up to just a handful of times where a child actually was shown to infect an adult rather than the other way around.
You did an interesting story just a couple of weeks ago, headlined What Parents Can Learn from Child Care Centers That Stayed Open During Lockdowns. Now, these are in America, not in Europe. And these were what centers, like Y centers across the country?
That's right. So the YMCA, which is one of the biggest providers of childcare in the country, created these emergency childcare programs for the children of essential workers and frontline workers like doctors. They operated with about 40,000 students or children at their peak, and they have no recorded cases of clusters.
Wow.
Meaning that, yes, so you don't really see, there's no recorded cases of clusters or outbreaks associated with these. Now, you know, they really went above and beyond. It was an extraordinary public-private effort where the kids were in pods of 10. You know, there's, you know, a lot of hand washing. There was mask wearing by the staff, not always by the children. So it's really something that I think we should be drawing on and paying close attention to.
And we're talking about little kids who, you know, it's hard to imagine a 3 or 4 year old would want to wear a mask all day, for instance, or even keep distance from their pals.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, you know, the idea of children needing to wear masks is actually not recommended by all medical authorities, especially really small children who, you know, they may be touching and adjusting the mask, and that might actually reduce the value of it because they're actually transferring and touching their face at the same time.
Let me get Lisa to join us. Lisa calling us from Phoenixville, Pennsylvania. Lisa, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm actually the former school board president here, so I'm very familiar with school board budgeting and funding. And the issue is we can get the money to do needed remodeling, like making sure we have windows that open, which is a very simple process for helping to have safe schools. We need relief from unfunded mandates like transportation and standardized testing. And that will open up funds for the schools to do what's needed. It also creates jobs, which we need right now. We can put people to work, carpenters, plumbers, electricians, getting them in there to upgrade HVAC systems, remodeling so that there's windows that open, creating outdoor pavilion class spaces.
Wow.
All of this can be done.
And Lisa, can it be done in the next?
Thank you.
Lisa, don't leave us. Can it be done in the next month or so?
So not for every school district, obviously. But we can go in and get started in those districts that have the largest achievement gap and students that need to be physically back in school the most. and we can prioritize those districts. I'm trying to get this to legislators and the governor's office. We can get people into schools now. We should have been doing this 2 months ago, but we can get schools now. And we can go into Philadelphia, we can go into Harrisburg, we can go into Chester, Upland, those, we can go into Coatesville. These districts need it the most. And here's the thing. If at the same time we remodel to renewable energy and we save money on energy costs, you create a revenue stream to repay the bonds in the future. Because, yes, somebody's going to have to do bonds to pay for this now.
Sure, sure.
But we can create revenue to pay for it.
I appreciate,
and it can be done.
Lisa, I appreciate your call and your enthusiasm. Anya, do you want to respond?
I mean, I'm hearing this kind of enthusiasm and problem solving will coming from local leaders all over the country. And it's really admirable. I think, what's standing out here is the lack of federal leadership. The Democratic controlled House passed a relief package for public schools back in May that would have allocated $58 billion, which would have given schools the ability to plan for this reopening. That bill has not been taken up by the Republican-controlled Senate. And so it's interesting to hear all of these calls from the administration to reopen public schools without kind of anything being said about how it's going to be funded.
I've heard some reports, I'm sure you have as well, about some camps that have had some experiences with this virus. Are there lessons, you think, from camps that we could apply to schools?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, the situations are a little bit different because if you have people actually living and sleeping in close quarters, mm-hmm. It's very difficult to conceive of any physical distancing happening in that situation. I think we also saw outbreaks that were associated with teenagers, older teens, and young adults, which we certainly know can get and spread the virus. So thinking about that, thinking about the fact that, yes, physical distancing probably really does matter, masks may really matter, so that we can reopen safely, but it doesn't mean you can do it with no precautions at all.
I'm going to talk with our other two guests about the American Academy of Pediatrics, but they did change some of their language about reopening. And I wonder, Anya, if you could speak to that.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I covered the initial statement that they made a couple of weeks ago, which really made news at the time because they did call in a full throat for children to come back to school. And they really emphasized all the risks that happen when children are at home, risks to development, risks to education, mental health, physical health. But I think what was maybe not anticipated was that this would become such a polarizing and political conversation, and that there would be a call to return to school, even if without the support for safety guidance. And so with a new statement they came out, they teamed up with teacher unions to talk about the fact that we can't do this unless we have the funds to do it safely.
And safely being the operative word.
Yes.
Anya Kamenetz, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times, getting our conversation started.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And she's education correspondent for NPR. And yes, we will carry on this conversation. If you're a teacher, if you are a custodian, if you work at a school, if you're a parent, if you're a student, we want to know what you're looking for as the new school year starts. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. I'm Marty Moscoe.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Ask most parents how things went this spring when their school-age kids were being taught at home online, and they'll say, not well, not well at all. Monitoring their children's learning, especially while working from home, turned out to be a frustrating challenge. No wonder many want their children back in the classroom come the new school year, but only if they can be safe from coronavirus. And adding to the confusion and anxiety are spikes in infection rates in parts of the country and conflicts between scientists and elected officials, including President Trump, who has threatened to withhold federal funds from districts that do not open their schools. Joining us and staying with us for the rest of the hour is Becky Pringle. She's a former middle school science teacher in Pennsylvania. She's also vice president of the National Education Association. Becky Pringle, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's so good to join you, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And also with us is David Rubin. He's director of the Policy Lab at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, also a professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. David Rubin, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
And I have to say, our phone lines have exploded. People want to talk about this. Here's that phone number once again, 1-888-477-9499. Let me start with a broad question, and I'll toss this first to you, Becky Pringle. What criteria should school districts use in order to decide whether they can open their doors to students, to teachers, to school personnel?
So, Marty, thank you for continuing this discussion.
Sure.
It's absolutely essential that we talk about how we open our schools safely. I heard in your previous segment, Anya, talking about the statement by our American Academy of Pediatrics and how they join now with educators and superintendents to really clarify what they were saying. We all know and believe that the best place for our students to be is physically in our schools.
Right.
We know that they depend on our schools, some of them, for meals. They depend on them for social-emotional health, as well as delivering high-quality academics. No one wants to be back in school physically more than our educators and the students themselves, as well as our parents. But we do not want to be in a place where we are given a false choice between whether they're safe,
right,
or whether they return to school. We know that we have a lot of work to do to ensure their safety. And I'll tell you, Marty, you know, we've been at this for a long time. Millions of students went out in March. And there have been months and months of opportunity to plan and prepare and to have leadership coming out of the White House to prepare for students to return to school. And we saw none of that, not any of it. And so we are working with our parents and others to talk about exactly what it is our students need. And we have been consistent in saying that we will follow the guidance of infectious disease experts, our doctors and our nurses and others who understand how we best keep people safe with social distancing and washing hands and sanitizing stations, making sure we have enough adults to be able to deliver that instruction safely. And we know we need PPE. We need all of those things.
Sure.
And we know that.
Okay. And I'm going to get back to you. Let me get our physician, our scientist in on the conversation. David Rubin, from your perspective, and we are seeing spikes in coronavirus in parts of this country, pretty serious and dramatic spikes. How should a district or a school board, how should they decide whether they can safely open their doors or not?
Well, I'm going to make this pretty simple. I think, you know, like, look, I agree with Becky. I mean, I think that the, you know, everyone's goal has been to get kids back for in-school learning. And there's no doubt about that the data on the preference for teaching kids within the classroom is far superior than for online learning options. But there's an issue of public confidence here. It's not simply a political decision that, you know, that parents need to feel like the classroom is safe, and I think teachers need to know that it's safe so that, you know, as they return to school as well. And that starts with understanding that we need to drive our case counts down and reduce the amount of community transmission. It's going to be far safer when we open our schools if the likelihood of an infected child or an infected teacher being in that classroom is lower. I would point people to guidance that was just issued by Governor Cuomo in the state of New York, which has tied the reopening of schools directly to issues of test positivity rates within the region. It's very simple to understand. Getting those rates down below 3%, for example, it creates a safer environment and makes everyone more confident with good mitigation strategies that schools can reopen.
David, just a quick follow-up, and then Becky, I'll get back to you. And we got a lot of people that want to join our conversation. We heard from our first guest talking about whether children are at greater or lesser risk for contracting coronavirus. What do we know about the infection rates when it comes to children?
I can tell you, I think there's decent evidence that, you know, certainly kids are having less severe infection in adults. There are some rare complications that have been mentioned in the press that we have seen at Children's Hospital, including the severe inflammatory syndrome, but they're rare. And we accept that children are at lower risk. And that's one of the reasons why we do think it's safer to reopen schools and that closing schools should be the last of the strategies that we consider when we are in a situation if there's a tremendous resurgent epidemic in the fall. We also believe they may be less transmissible in terms of transmitting to other students or adults. However, children don't live in a vacuum. I mean, they go home to parents and caregivers. We have 95,000 grandparents caring for kids, and then you have the teachers themselves in these classrooms as well. And so the risk is not zero, and it actually increases with the age of the child. Older youth, I think there's decent evidence now that our high school youth are seeing infection rates that are quite similar. They may not be as sick, but they're also transmitting. And so the answer here is not just to accept that that children are at lower risk. It's to recognize that schools can be places where transmission can occur. We've seen that in other countries now, in Israel, for example. We've even seen daycare outbreaks and camp outbreaks here in the United States, particularly in areas with high transmission. The goal is to get transmission rates down as low as possible so you're conferred the advantages of those lower transmission rates in kids and the lower severity.
Becky Pringle, let me turn back to you. And I'm thinking about the thousands, I don't know how many thousands of teachers we have in this country, but sort of what teachers want and what they are looking for to ensure that their students are safe, but also that they're going to be safe in a classroom. And I'm thinking if you have to distance in a classroom, so much of what I remember from school was the teacher leaning over my shoulder and looking at what I was working on in my desk. How do we educate children from afar?
Right, Marty. And I appreciate, Marty, that you started the segment reminding folks that it's not only our teachers, it's our custodians, it's our nurses, our food service workers, our paraprofessionals who are working so closely with our students with disabilities. So with all of those caring adults in the building that we need to be concerned with, and we know that we have many of those educators who are at higher risk. And we have to be concerned with that because it's not only about reopening the schools, but if an outbreak occurs, even if the students aren't getting sick, if the adults get sick, what are we doing? What's the plan to address that reality that likely could happen if we're not making sure that everyone's safe? And so what our educators are looking for, and they're concerned, Marty. They're really concerned. Because they have been coming together and demanding that the Senate act on the HEROES Act that Congress passed. And Ms. McConnell's on a two-week vacation right now while folks are talking about them going back to school. And they're not acting on providing the resources. So our educators are very worried that they're not listening to them and saying and considering them essential workers. They're very worried about whether this country really puts its students first or whether it's putting big corporations first when we think about the COVID relief money that has been put into the economy. And so they're concerned about whether or not they will have the protective gear. Marty, you may or may not know this, but already with state economies feeling the weight of what's happening with COVID-19, over 500,000 of our educators have already been laid off. And we're predicting that almost 2 million could be laid off during what we know we are facing in an economic recession.
For financial reasons? There isn't the money there, you're saying?
Right. So they're worried if you lay off more teachers, how in the world could we possibly send kids back to school and social distance? We've come up with lots of hybrid models and things like that, but you actually have to have the educators in schools. So they're very concerned that they will get the protective equipment they need, that there will be enough of them, that they will have nurses. There are schools right now that don't even have nurses.
Right.
And they're talking about laying off. So that's what they're very concerned about, whether or not policymakers who are making decisions about whether to give resources to schools will do it.
Let me turn back to you, David Rubin, and picking up on what Becky Pringle just said, should we then think of teachers as essential workers and treat them the way we have with medical staff? I realize, not that hasn't gone particularly well, but nonetheless, making sure that they have the kind of protective gear that they're going to need in order to be in a classroom.
Oh, absolutely. I consider teachers essential workers. That goes without saying.
But it seems like, I mean, I agree with you on that, but I wonder whether as a country we think of teachers that way and whether we should.
Well, yeah, I've looked at a lot of school reopening plans, and all of them are unified with respect to some basic principles, and that's and one of those principles is we need to protect the teachers and the staff within the schools, and they have very strict requirements and supply chain to help them make sure they have the protective gear and the effective distancing they need to be safe. And so I think, you know, I totally agree with your comments, but I do believe that as you go district to district that people recognize that, our state recognizes that. The question is, will the supply chain be in place for the kinds of hygiene and disinfection and the provision of that protective equipment so that, you know, teachers feel confident that they're safe when they reenter the classroom? I will remind folks, you know, it's not dissimilar to when I returned to work at my own practice. In the spring, we were terrified. Our staff within our office was terrified. The uncertainty about what this could do to you. But you know, the provision of that personal protective equipment and the practices we did around distancing within our office and how we moved children and families through our pediatric office, I feel actually safer when I go to my office now than when I'm out in the community.
Wow.
And I think we want our teachers to feel the same way when they enter a school.
Absolutely. Let me get Ira to join our conversation. Ira calling us from Philadelphia. Ira is a teacher. You're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Hey, so I'm a teacher in the Philadelphia area, and, you know, I feel like that the teachers are going to be sort of like the guinea pigs, the experiment to see what happens for the sake of the economy. I was just reading in Israel that, like, when the schools opened, it pretty much, that was the next wave that hit them. And, you know, in our schools, there's very little soap and hand sanitizer, and, like, they're saying they're not going to check the kids at all, and they have to do it at home, and I don't want to be a statistic. And I have a girlfriend who has, you know, a condition already that if I bring it home, I don't want to be a Trojan horse to her. So, like, I don't, and you know that once everything's done, like, once it opens, they're going to close it again and do work from home. And I hated working from home. It's awful. Like, yeah. I had some kids at work, but out of my 60-some kids, maybe like a third of to a half of them did work. And then there's kids that no one knows what happened to them, just like they didn't go online at all. And it's awful, and it doesn't work well as it is, but I don't, the alternative, what's better, a kid that's a little behind or a kid that's, you know, sick or, like, kills other people in his family because of it? So, I mean, you know, I just have a lot of mixed emotions right now because I want to teach. I want to be in the classroom, but I don't think it's safe for me right now, especially, you know, with the numbers going up pretty much everywhere.
I appreciate your call, Ira. I appreciate the fact that you're a teacher as well. Let me give Becky Pringle a chance to respond. And he really, Becky, kind of laid out the pros and the cons and the great anxiety that he has both for the students but also for teachers as well.
Absolutely. Ira, thank you for your dedicated service for on behalf of our students and this country. And Marty,
yeah.
Ira reflects what we're hearing from our teachers all over this country. They want to go back. The experience they had this spring was not what they went into teaching for. It was not. And the way that we quickly went to online learning did not allow them to prepare, to work together, to collaborate with their support staff and parents and the students themselves. And so it was not the best condition for learning for anyone, honestly, but certainly for our students that we know have historically been marginalized, historically have suffered inequities, our Black and brown students, our students with disabilities. And so as we think about reopening schools, we have to talk about those issues of equity and access and opportunity long-term, honestly. Marty, long-term.
Sure.
But certainly in the short term, we know that those communities are at greater risk. They're at greater risk to get the virus. They're at greater risk to succumb to it. And so we have to think about all of those things. So Ira really reflects what we are hearing from every teacher. They want to be with their kids, but they are afraid for their students. They are afraid for their communities, their parents. They're afraid for themselves and for their own families. And they have not seen any evidence of what David just described about what's happened in his office. That was a perfect example of exactly what we're asking for. But folks are saying we don't have the money to do that.
Yeah,
and,
I hear you.
And you know what, Marty? I will tell you, I've had folks say to me, you know, you're just asking for money. What is it, isn't there something else? Why don't you ask for plexiglass? And I said, okay, that costs money. To do what David did in his office, that costs money, and it's not okay that this society is saying that our students are not worth it. Ira, thank you for sharing the voice of teachers all over this country.
David, let me just pick up on, and I'm seeing the Philadelphia announced WHYY reporting that return to school in person this fall on a part-time basis, attend classes twice a week, and completing the rest of the schoolwork online. We will pick up on that. But let me just ask you, David, about a minute before our break here. I mean, if a school is requiring masks and hand washing and distancing, all the preventive things that we are supposed to do, is that a recipe for a successful opening if a school, a classroom is able to do that?
I absolutely think it is. I mean, it has to occur under the circumstance where we have low circulating transmission in the community. When we look to the successes in Europe, they were successful because they drove down their case counts. And so it starts with getting case counts down. And then with good mitigation efforts, and I've seen some really good plans coming out of the districts, so, you know, I think we can talk about what a high-quality plan looks like. I really identify with what Ira just talked about. I mean, people have to have the confidence that they'll be safe, and I talked about our own anxiety. Our nurses, our nursing staff, they share the same risks that our teachers and our staff have, you know, returning to school as well, you know, not simply our doctors. And I can tell you the confidence comes with seeing the plan in action and recognizing that really we have not seen secondary infections in our staff since we instituted our mitigation strategies. We see sick children coming in our office every day. So there's a way to do this well and not have people feel like they're guinea pigs, and rather that they're part of the solution and that they feel safe when they go into environments, even when there might be some transmission occurring among the children.
And we have to take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about how to reopen our schools safely. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on
supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
WHYY in Philadelphia, talking about how to reopen schools once the school year starts, how to open them safely. This just in from WHYY, the School District of Philadelphia students will return to school in person this fall, but on a part-time basis. The plan calls for students to attend classes in their respective school buildings twice a week while completing the rest of their work online. Some high needs students will have the option to attend school 4 days a week, as will pre-K students. Families that don't feel comfortable sending their children to in-person school can opt for all virtual instruction. And again, our guests are David Rubin. He's director of the Policy Lab at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He's a pediatrician and a professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. Becky Pringle with us as well, former middle school science teacher in Pennsylvania. She is currently the vice president of the National Education Association. And again, you can join us. We want your questions, your comments, your reactions. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Becky Pringle, just sort of based on what I just read there, which is just a couple of sentences from WHYY, what's your reaction to what the district has decided in Philadelphia?
Well, I hope the Philadelphia School District and all school districts throughout the country will continue to monitor and pay attention to a couple of things. First of all, thank you, David, for lifting up what Governor Cuomo is doing in New York around staying the course and monitoring those infection rates. And that's something that everyone can help with.
you know, following the CDC safety guidelines, looking, you know, looking at your role and responsibility and bringing those infection rates down within your community so that that's not something that our students are dealing with as they go back to school. So I hope that Philadelphia and every other school district will continue to monitor that and adjust as needed. I don't know whether Philadelphia is getting the kind of resources they need or if they have them, but what Ira described about schools, and I believe he said he was a teacher in Philadelphia, is mm-hmm. absolutely true. I go visit schools all over this country, and I'll go into the girls' bathroom, and there's no soap in the dispenser at all. We know that in fact, some school districts have been sued because of the health crisis that they have and then because of black mold. And nothing's changed about that. So the ventilation in the schools, all of those things, I hope that every school district is looking at. And then the other thing that I want to lift up to is when we talk about reopening schools, we need to make sure that within their plans they have testing and tracking. We're very concerned about the testing in particular because we're seeing that throughout the country. While at some points they're saying it's available, and other points not so available, results sporadically or, you know, coming back in a reasonable time. So those kinds of things have to be included in any kind of plan as well.
David, let me turn back to you. And there are some countries, Norway, Denmark, and some other, I believe some countries in Asia, that seem to have been able to figure out how to get children safely back in schools. And I realize, you know, we're a very different country. We're very decentralized, certainly when it comes to education. Are there lessons that we can apply here in the United States?
Well, yeah, the first lesson, as I've sort of mentioned, is to get our case counts down.
Right.
You know, everything is safer when there's less virus circulating in the community. And so, you know, as much as we want to extrapolate from these other areas, it's hard to do it unless we get our case counts down. So that would be the first thing. The second thing is, you know, as we've reviewed the recommendations and speaking to the issues in Philadelphia, there are structural issues in our school systems, particularly in our urban school systems. Years of neglect of funding, structural and infrastructural needs that have created a really challenging circumstance here. Is that the Philadelphia school system can't fulfill the CDC recommendations in terms of spacing and distancing and have classes with 30 plus kids in them. And so the practical reality was they had to go to a flex schedule system right. to preserve their ability to do the effective distancing and mitigation strategies they need to do to create a safe classroom. It's unfortunate, but it's not something we're going to be able to fix, in the last 6 weeks of summer. And our team at Policy Hub and many others around, including our other infectious disease experts at CHOP and other folks around the nation, you know, we actually believe there's part of these recommendations include this recommendation around occupancy of the classroom and the amount of distancing students should be doing. And there have been different opinions about that, but we've held firm that we should be preserving 6 feet of distancing within the classroom among the children if we can. And that's based on pretty good evidence around the spread of respiratory viruses that are spread in similar ways to the coronavirus in terms of minimizing risk. And what we said was if you can't achieve that 6 feet of distancing, it would be preferable to go to flex scheduling so you can reduce the number mm-hmm. of children in the classroom, because I don't think it would be safe to have teachers like Ira or others or teaching staff to walk into a classroom with 30-plus students. The risk is just too high.
And just to underscore what you're saying, and, we've done untold numbers of programs about this pandemic, David, which is the importance of wearing masks, the importance of distancing, the importance of washing hands, because we don't have a cure yet. And so we're in a sense, stuck with these preventive measures.
Exactly. I think we're trying to come up with the best strategy to reduce transmission among people. While we hopefully wait for a successful right. vaccine to enter the discussion. And certainly if that vaccine becomes available as essential workers, I would suspect that teachers would be in the first round for vaccine delivery should the vaccines that are in trial right now be successful. And so in the absence of that, we know that social distancing is extremely effective. It is the most effective intervention. And so what you're trying to do is take advantage of the best interventions around distancing, whether it's masks or whether it's physical distancing of the students or cohorting of the students to prevent transmission. And if you can keep transmission extremely low, and certainly if you can distance the teachers effectively through the use of personal protective equipment and physically distancing them from students in the class, I think we have a real chance of success. Again, assuming that we've gotten our case counts down to create a safe environment that the public feels is safe for students and teachers to return to.
Let me just read a couple of comments. PJ saying, my impression is that the Trump administration is desperate to reopen the schools and universities to project a facade of normalcy in the run-up to the election. Chris asks, what about special needs children and the risk that returning to school pose for them? Becky, I wonder if you could speak to that. And there are certainly are special needs children who would be at serious risk if they were to contract this virus. What can be done to help those students?
The same thing we've been talking about so far that David has lifted up, as well as the precautions that we laid out throughout this discussion. We know that our students with disabilities have special needs. We know that sometimes the distancing that is required to keep everyone safe is a challenge, particularly with our students who have those physical disabilities. And so we are working with that community, with the disability community, to figure out how we can best provide the kind of learning that all of our students need, even for our students with disabilities. But again, we need the additional resources to do that. And David, I could not agree more. You know, the clock is ticking. I cannot imagine that a school is prepared to open now. Without the funding that has not come yet and the planning. And I wanted to say this too, Marty. It is absolutely essential that educators are involved in whatever plans are being made. You know, I said earlier about the infectious disease experts being absolutely essential in guiding us on when schools would be safe to be reopened, and then the how of it has got to include educators and parents and the students themselves, by the way, involving them in those decisions on how best to do that, and making sure we have enough time to put those things in place. You know, right now we have more guidelines that are telling hair salons and restaurants what they need to do. We have inspectors that are inspecting to make sure they're doing these things right, and we don't have that for our schools. That's just not okay. It is not okay that we're not doing the same for our students.
Let me read a couple of more comments, and then we'll get Diane from Phoenixville to join us. Charlotte says, we should be thinking outside the box. What about all the closed businesses with empty office spaces? We could use those office buildings for kids to spread out more. In rural areas in Pennsylvania, schools are now saying they will not bus the children, and therefore parents would be responsible to get the children to and from school. This is not possible for most families. David, let me just get a quick response from you, if you don't mind, about this whole busing issue and getting children to and from school. What are the challenges there?
Well, you know, before I return to the issue of busing, I do want to answer for families of children with special health care needs, because we've thought about this at CHOP. Fortunately, and this is an advantage, we're not seeing children with special health care needs get sick at greater rates than other healthier children in the community. That's terrific. And, you know, that's different than influenza, where we do actually see those differences. And what it means is we should not be removing children from in-classroom instruction because they have a special health care need or a special education need. In fact, those are the children that probably need to be in school the most. And when we go to flex scheduling, we would prefer to see options for children with special needs and those of essential health worker or essential workers who might be needed during resurgence, given priority for in-school instruction because of the importance, particularly around special education needs, that in-school instruction has for those children. Now, to the question of the busing, it's an extremely important issue. And again, that the potential for transmission on a bus is much higher than it would be sort of in outdoor settings. It's one of those moments of transmission that you think about. We've been encouraging schools to inventory just how many parents are actually going to put their kids on the buses, because there may be some natural advantages as more people send their kids to school by driving them to school.
Assuming you have a car, though.
In the city of Philadelphia, yeah. For example, because they're on public transportation. But they'll have to observe the sort of mask wearing and the strategies that that are put in place by the Philadelphia Public Health Department. But that said, the schools also need to think about their parent pickup lines, because I suspect there will be a lot more kids traveling to school by car, and getting kids into the school building is going to be challenging for all districts as we start to see the ways in which kids transport to school change a bit.
Let me get Diane calling us from Phoenixville. And Diane, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there, Diane. Go ahead.
Hi. So I'm a teacher, and we just had our Zoom meeting about our reopening plans. And for in school, we either have the parents have the choice of doing all virtual or all in school. So for the in school option, our social distancing is 3 feet. And I'm just wondering why only in a school setting is the safe distance considered to be half of what it is, you know, worldwide.
Oh, that's an interesting and important question, Diane. Let me give David a chance to respond. David, just quickly, if you don't mind, 3 feet versus six, what do you think?
Well, I can tell you that opinion was it has been the result of the World Health Organization issuing what I think was some controversial guidelines that 3 to 6 feet would be acceptable. The CDC has not embraced the 3 foot guideline. Our team at CHOP has not embraced the 3 foot guideline. And I think it was a hedge to say, you know, if kids are transmitting less, maybe we could sort of forgive a little bit of the distancing between students' desks. We don't feel confident that that will work well. And I worry about overcrowding classrooms and conferring too much risk to the teachers who might be in those classrooms. So I'm not supportive of 3 foot distancing between desks as a strategy for the fall. I understand why places have to do that, but I think if you need to go down to 3 feet, that's when you should be thinking about flex scheduling, and certainly thinking about the use of teaching assistants who may be younger in that classroom, as opposed to putting the regular workforce there who may have their own health conditions in a crowded classroom.
Diane, I appreciate your call. Becky, the final question to you. Thinking about the thousands and thousands of teachers, what teachers hope then once the school year starts? And we're hearing a diverse perspective on what they are concerned about and what they hope happens. What should we be looking for?
We should be looking for the federal government providing leadership. We should be looking for our students and parents and educators to get the resources they need, so they're not in a situation where they're going down the 3 feet because that's what they have to do. We should not be faced with those choices. Our teachers and other educators want to be with our students, and our students need to be with them. But the very first thing that we have to ensure is the health and safety of all. That's what we have to ensure, and we can do it. The question is, do we have the will? That's the question.
Well, I'm going to leave it there because that's a provocative and important question. Becky Pringle, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty.
You're welcome. And she's vice president of the National Education Association. She was a middle school science teacher here in Pennsylvania. David Rubin, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
And you're very welcome. He's director of CHOP's Policy Lab, that's Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, also professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you for joining us. Thank you.